Good evening, everybody. May I introduce myself, first of all? I am Diane Perrins. I'm the new director of the Gender Institute. And we're delighted to welcome you this evening to the second in our series of lectures on women in the economy. We have a panel of very distinguished speakers who are distinguished in their own field in a variety of ways. They share, however, one thing in common, and that is that within their particular field, they are a minority, and in most cases, a very small minority at that. What will happen is I will briefly introduce each of the speakers. They will then speak for about 10 to 15 minutes, and then we'll open the floor to questions. Okay, so first of all, let me introduce the speakers. I'll do it in order. First of all, on my immediate right, we have Rachel Lomax, who is a practicing economist. She is an ex-LSE student, a graduate on the master's course in economics, and she's also a governor of the LSE. Rachel broke 300 years of history by being the first ever woman director, deputy governor of the Bank of England with responsibility for monetary policy. She's also been involved in working at the World Bank and a number of other distinguished positions within the economy. Sitting next to Rachel Lomax, we have Eleanor Lang, who is the Shadow Minister for Women from 2004. Previously, she was the Shadow Minister for Children, and prior to that had a variety of positions in the House of Commons and working for various aspects of the Conservative Party. She is MP for Epping Forest, and she likewise broke with tradition by becoming the first ever president of the Edinburgh Students' Union when a student, so another first there. And then on my extreme right, but not on the extreme right, we have Professor Susan Himmelwhite from the Open University. Susan Himmelwhite is an academic, economist, but also is involved in the Women's Budget Group. She is co-chair of the Women's Budget Group. And she too is a minority in that there are very few women professors in this country and even fewer professors of economics. So each of our speakers is in a minority, and we've invited all of them to reflect on the basis of their knowledge and their personal experience, whether the increased presence of women in the economy is having any impact in terms of the organisation of the economy, and also to think about, with this feminisation of employment, what has happened for women, what has changed, what has remained the same. Are there any barriers to women's progress in the economy? And if so, how might those barriers be overcome? So while we're experiencing a lot of change at the moment, I suppose the big question is, how significant are these changes and how much has remained the same? And also, perhaps, to what extent have the changes for some women had adverse consequences for others? So these are some of the issues I would like the speakers to address. Just before we begin, however, I have some rather unfortunate news for us, possibly good news for foxes, in that Harriet Harman is not able to be with us this evening because of a vote that's about to take place on the hunting bill in Parliament. So I'm very sorry about that. She conveys her apologies, and it's possible that Eleanor Lang may have to leave rather hurriedly in order to get to the House of Commons for one of these votes. So we're very sorry about that. We didn't receive the knowledge until very recently, and as a consequence of not being able to organise a replacement. So apologies for that. But without more ado, I'd like to offer the floor to Eleanor Lang, who will be our first speaker. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed. It's a great pleasure to be here this evening. I have to apologise in advance in case I do have to rush away, because it may or may not be good news for foxes, but it's quite a big vote. Well, actually, three quite big votes in the House of Commons later this evening. And the way procedures work, we never know quite when the votes are going to occur. It depends how long people speak for. And given the subject that they're speaking on and the passions that it arouses, it's quite likely that they'll speak for quite a long time. And I hope I might be able to stay with you for the whole of the debate. But if not, I'll have to rush back. I had hoped that Harriet Harman would be here this evening so that we could have a reasoned debate here showing that women get excited politically about subjects rather more important to our everyday lives than fox hunting. But that's not my choice. So I'm sorry that these two particularly important events have clashed this evening. I'm speaking first simply because the other speakers have very kindly suggested that I might do so in case I have to rush away. But in a way, it's the wrong way around, because the other two speakers this evening are experts in their fields. They are they are academics who know this subject inside out. I'm a mere politician, and what I do is take the facts which are brought forward by the academics and turn them to political use. And you might say, oh, what is the political use of examining a subject such as this? And the answer is, it's extremely important, because there is a larger proportion of women in the workforce now than ever before, both in part-time and in full-time employment. And on top of that, there is a larger number of women than ever before doing two jobs simultaneously, namely a job for which she is paid and the job of looking after children or a family or elderly relatives. And from a political point of view, that's important, because there is a sector of our community which has often in the past been neglected, overlooked, and taken for granted. And that should no longer be the case in the 21st century, and some of us in Parliament want to make sure that it is no longer the case. May I begin by welcoming the 10 years of the Gender Institute, which we are celebrating in holding this series of debates. The very fact that the LSE has a Gender Institute is a step in the right direction, because the subjects which are important to women and to women's place in the economy and in society are being properly examined. And, of course, one mustn't forget, in dealing with gender issues, the position that men occupy in the economy and in society is equally important. But what we have to do sometimes in looking at the woman's position, and I do it all the time, believe me, when you're a conservative and you're the spokesman for women, the first question that you're often asked is, so why isn't there a minister for men? Don't men need a minister too? Which is a facile and silly question, because anyone who thinks about it knows that what we have to do politically is to redress centuries of bias against women in the economy and in society, no matter how you look at it, whether it's bias against women that has been developed on purpose or whether it's bias against women, which occurs simply because in some societies women are so busy bearing children that they don't have time or energy or ability to do anything else, then nevertheless that bias occurs. And unless we take positive steps in the political field to try to redress it, then it will never be redressed. And there are still those who will say, well, why bother? We have a perfectly good balance if men do paid employment and women look after families and domestic chores. There are people who still say that. And I think that's politically unacceptable, because every human being should have a choice as far as is possible within their society and within the economic restraints of the society in which they live. There should be a choice of how to lead their own life. In Britain, and I guess in Western Europe, the Western world generally, progress in the last 100 years has been significant. It's little over 100 years ago that a married woman wasn't even allowed to own property. She was just sort of passed herself from her father to her husband, and that all she owned went with her. Women certainly had no political power. We all know that. I don't have to redress the arguments. But there are women still alive today who, when they were 21 years old, were not able to exercise a vote. So the progress that has been made in bringing any kind of gender equality has been massive over the last century. And I would argue that in the last 30 years, it's been phenomenal. But we keep thinking that we're soon going to get there. I remember when I went to university for the first time in the late 70s, it seemed to me that equality had been achieved. It seemed to me that because there were more or less equal numbers of men and women in the law faculty at Edinburgh University, which was where I started my university career, equal numbers of students, that we were achieving some kind of equality. But when I look back now, just over 20 years later, and I look at the number of men who started in Edinburgh Law Faculty on the same day as me, and the number of women, and count the number of men who are partners in firms or directors of companies or in some other way have had an obviously successful career, and I count the number of women who have, there's a huge disparity. And of course, there are various reasons for it. And one of the reasons is that many of the women have chosen not just to have a straight career path, but to do something else, which is extremely important, not just for us personally, not just for families, not just for society, but for the economy, and that is to give birth to the next generation. And while we are, well, that's a silly thing to say, isn't it? While we are balancing those two necessities of economic ability and the need to produce children, well, of course, we'll always be balancing those because we're not going to give up producing the next generation. And women are always going to have to do it. I know I'm stating the obvious, but this is a debate, and I'm a politician. So women are always going to have to do it. While that balance has to be achieved, then we have to find political means of bringing about the flexibility that makes that balance fair and gives women the chance in life that men have always had. During the 1970s and 1980s, I would argue that many women achieved success in their field by leading men's lives, by putting aside or postponing childbearing, or else doing it very quickly and going back to work, as some brilliantly efficient women have managed to do. I don't count myself among them. I managed to, after many years of juggling all sorts of different responsibilities, I managed to fight a general election and win it and produce my son within 1 week. And you would have thought that in 40 years of life, I could have managed to separate those two enormously important and traumatic events by more than 7 days, which just shows that planning isn't always possible. But then I didn't plan the general election. It was Tony Blair who did that. As to the other part, I'll leave that aside. But I'm happy to report that that my son, who is now 3 1/4, is very happy and healthy. And having been born a week after a general election, what he wants for Christmas from Santa Claus is a microphone so that he can make speeches. So I will not answer questions on whether I'm bringing my son up properly or not. I think that's a rather more difficult issue. During the 1970s and 1980s, I would argue that many women did achieve what they achieved by leading men's lives. And this was brought to my attention at one point when I had a meeting about 10 years ago in the capacity I had then as a special advisor to the then leader of the House of Commons, a meeting with the chief medical officer who was talking about women and alcohol and the growing consumption of alcohol amongst women. And he said, "Minister, you would hardly believe this, but we have evidence that young women are trying to lead lives exactly in parallel with young men. Do you know that it is quite possible to go into a city wine bar at 7 o'clock on a weekday evening and find that there might be 2 young professional women there just sitting at a table together, and that they will consume between them in the evening a whole bottle of wine?" Well, I have to say I was rather shocked that they were only consuming 1 bottle of wine. And that the government's chief medical officer thought that this was scandalous, that women are leading the same lives as men. But indeed, until a certain point in life, I would argue that a woman can lead the same life as a man. And I don't know what the other speakers on the panel will say about their own experience, but I certainly found that for about the first 10 years of my working, nearly 10 years of my working life, I wasn't discriminated against because I was a woman. Not at all, because I was leading a man's life. I had no children. I had no other responsibilities. I could do all the things that a man could do. I never had to say, "Sorry, I can't stay late," or "Sorry, I can't work on Saturday." I never had to say that. And the amount of wine I consumed in a wine bar might be a matter best not disclosed by a respectable front bench politician, but I could lead a man's life. But there comes a point when a woman can't do that, and that's when the problems kick in. And it's all of our responsibility, I would say, to deal with those problems. Because old-fashioned politicians used to say, well, if a woman chooses to go off and have a child, you can't expect us to keep her job open for her. That's her choice, isn't it? Well, what if the woman doesn't choose to have the child? What if all the high-achieving and genetically intelligent women in the country decide that they're not going to play a dual role, that they're not going to make their own lives very, very difficult and not produce children? What will then happen to society and the economy? We need women in the economy. A company which has employed and trained a woman for, let's say, 10 years can't afford to lose her from the workforce if she then has a child or children. So we must have systems which allow flexibility and allow women to return to work at the level at which they left work, not at a lower level, if a woman so chooses, while at the same time respecting that many women will decide to have a second career, which is a complete devotion to bringing up children, which I would argue is much more difficult than any other job, and I'm glad I don't have to do it full time. But if a woman does choose to do that full-time, then we must respect that choice and give economic support and political support through the tax and benefits system. I had hoped that if Harriet Harman were to be here this evening, that we might have been able to present the different sides of the political spectrum as far as looking at women in the economy is concerned. But in fact, it's not desperately difficult for me to present both sides, because I found to my great surprise the last time we did questions, women's questions, once a month we have a chance for 10 minutes to have questions about women in the House of Commons. And I asked the questions, and Patricia Hewitt, the Minister for Women and Secretary of State for Trade and Industry, answers them. And last time, we found ourselves most awkwardly in agreement with one another. And I leave you with this final thought as a debating point, that I am totally against any kind of quota system that insists upon or allows a certain number of women in a certain number of places. It's not the way to do it, because if we go down the women-only shortlist, the must-have a certain number of women at every level in a company or in any organization, that's like saying that a man can swim on his own, but a woman always needs to wear armbands because she can't do it on her own. You're about to hear from two women who know about this subject far, far better and in a better-based academic way than I do. And they have both achieved great success in their roles, not through quotas, but through talent. And if we have the will to be flexible in the way we run our society, our tax system, our benefits system, and our attitudes to women in the workforce, then the equality which is necessary, not just for a well-balanced society, but for a successful successful economy, will be achieved if we keep pursuing it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Eleanor. I'm just dying to ask whether you and Patricia were alone in the house when you exchanged these questions, or whether, in fact, you get an audience for this in the
huge
house.
Huge audience.
Well, that's
no,
very
about
reassuring.
20 people.
Okay. Right, now I'd like to ask Rachel Lomax, the Deputy Governor of the Bank of England, to speak. Thank you.
Well, I feel I ought to come clean. I'm not an expert on this subject at all. I don't know anything about gender economics. I was a civil servant for most of my career. I worked in the Treasury for 25 years, which was slightly odd because there weren't that many women who did sort of policy jobs in the Treasury. Can you hear me?
Not too well, I think.
Can you hear me now? Well, is it working? All right, okay, I shall burst into song. Can you hear me now? Okay, I was just trying to clear up some misapprehensions as to who I am and why I'm here. I'm not a specialist in gender economics. I wouldn't even describe myself as an academic economist. I spent most of my career since I left LSE as a civil servant. I was in the Treasury for 25 years, which was a pretty male-dominated place. I was a Treasury economist. I've also been a permanent secretary of three government departments, one of which was the Department of Work and Pensions, which pays out benefits and does job centres and things like that, a job which occasioned very little comment. Nobody ever said, gosh, a woman head of this department. And we might discuss why it occasioned so little surprise. I became deputy governor of the Bank of England, a much smaller organisation, and where I am the deputy, and suddenly it's amazing. Why? It's quite interesting. I suppose the other bit of biographical fact I might throw in before we get into the what I've made of the subject and the enormous exam questions which Dan gave us, is that I have had children. I've got two sons that are now well and truly grown up, and a granddaughter. And, you know, that was a big issue, how to fit that into my career. But it's not the only issue. Children are not the only issue. And maybe we might just come on to that later on. Although I'm not a gender economist, a long practice makes me want to start off on a subject like this by assembling a few stylized facts and trying to ask myself what my main question might be. And it seems to me that some of the key stylized facts about women in the economy might be as follows. I mean, where we are now, beginning of the 21st century, women are nearly as likely to be in paid employment as men. But they work fewer hours, mostly because they're much more likely to work part-time. They do tend to cluster in certain, often less well-paid occupations. And it's certainly true that the top jobs are still mostly done by men. Women earn less over their lifetimes, and they are much poorer in old age. The new pension credit, which Gordon Brown introduced last year, for poorer pensioners, two-thirds of the recipients of that pension credit are women. One of the most dramatic changes, I think, during the course of my adult life has been what's happened to the gender gap in education. When I was at LSE, there were two other women on the master's course with me. There were 250 people in total. And it is scarcely surprising to me that, you know, so few women have come through in economic professions because they simply weren't trained. I suspect I'm the oldest person on this panel by some distance. I was at Cambridge at a time when women were in a terribly small minority. I think there were 10% of the undergraduate population was women. So one reason why practically every job I've done for the last 25 years, I have been the first woman, is because basically women were not qualified to do these jobs. I'm one of the sort of early generation of people who basically got the right qualifications and stuck with the job. Now, I just think that situation has been transformed. Women have equipped themselves for the labour market, and they stay in the labour market. And that is just a huge change. But there's still significant differences in the subjects that girls and boys and men and women study. I mean, I don't know how many people are on master's course in economics at LSE now, but I'll bet you anything it's not 50-50. You look at the A-levels, all the sort of maths-based subjects, boys outnumber girls really quite significantly. Physics, maths, economics, anything which is maths-based tends to be still very engineering, tends to be very dominated by boys. Girls still seem to go for language-based courses, English, literature, history, the social studies. And this seems to be quite a marked pattern. So even though girls are getting themselves much better educated and level of achievement is there, there is quite a significant pattern in what they choose to study. So my sort of take on all these stylized facts is that gender remains a significant influence on labour market outcomes today, although you can see some issues, some trends, which are beginning to close some of the gaps, and clearly there is change in the pipeline. And the question of why gender is still so significant when you look at the labour market and the economy is one which I think is worth thinking about. Clearly, as Ellen has said, caring responsibilities matter. It's more than just children. It's caring. If you have caring responsibility for elderly people, it disproportionately falls on women still. And I think the key thing, if I've understood the evidence aright, what really matters in a career is a broken career. You are severely penalised for having a broken career. There's a very interesting, and that's male and female, there's a very interesting study that was done of Vietnam veterans, and I agree that's going back a few decades now. But people who took time out to go to Vietnam and fight in Vietnam, I mean, basically lost earning and lost career position relative to people who didn't. You know, correcting for all other variables, and you know, the labour market seems to penalise breaks. It's difficult to get back, and so I think people who take time out pay the price. I mean, I did take time out actually. I took a bit of time off when my kids were born, and I was part time. And actually, getting back on level terms with my male colleagues required an enormous burst of effort. Because you tend to lose out on the training and all the rest of it. Now, I don't know whether that is still true to the same extent, but it was a big issue in my career, certainly. I do think culture matters enormously. I'm not really up on this literature, and maybe Susan is more so than me, but as I understand the evidence across countries, you know, occupational segregation, which is what we've got in this country to a certain extent. You've got women working in particular sectors of the economy. They are not spread evenly across the economy. They're disproportionately in the sorts of things that culturally women sort of did in the home, as it were. They're in caring and teaching and interpersonal type activities, and there's a very clear pattern of occupational segregation. As I understand it, that is something which doesn't vary with level of economic development. I mean, basically, it's a cultural thing. I don't think it's a simply you can see that as purely an economic issue. I do think culture matters tremendously when you look at what people choose to do. Groups matter. I mean, male-dominated groups are not the same as female-dominated groups. Which group, and workplaces are all about group behaviour. It's hopeless thinking that, you know, just who... I remember when I first started off, I thought, well, you know, if I am well-educated and I work hard and I sort of do all the right things, that's all that matters. It's not so. You know, people. You are a member of a group, and a woman in a male-dominated group is in a different position from a woman in a woman's group. Being an outsider is an issue. It's a big issue, whatever kind of outsider you happen to be. And I do think that is one of the elements in this whole area. It really did feel quite different to me working in the Department of Work and Pensions, which has got a lot more women, because it's a sort of social policy type area, than working in the Treasury or the Bank of England, which are hard economics and where it's very male-dominated. And it's much more comfortable to be with other women. You're much more relaxed. I didn't realise how much difference it made, actually, until I went to an organisation with more women. It's many different levels of... There's a point of which it's not just, you know, it's how you position yourself in the group. It's how relaxed you are. It's a whole subject in its own right. The whole question of women in top jobs, I think, is an interesting one. I think it's very odd to get into a top job at all. I think most people don't get to the top. So you're looking at odd people anyhow. You have to ask why people sort of succeed in this excessive way. And I think they're people who have a lot of drive and a lot of positive reinforcement. takes a lot of positive reinforcement to succeed. And people don't go in for competitions, they think they're going to lose. And I think that women hold themselves back because they think they're going to lose this competition. And actually, if you look at the pattern of previous success, they are. So, you know, there is that whole problem of people putting themselves at risk of failure. And people don't like to put themselves at risk of failure. If you think that you're going to go in for a competition, you're going to lose. You know, you don't want to do it. And you see the same thing, I think, with ethnic minorities as well. People hold themselves back to protect themselves from failure in a situation where they can see that the probabilities of success look rather low according to past track record. The other thing that matters, thinking about gender in the workplace, cohorts matter. I mean, today's young women, I mentioned my position in the workforce, but today's young women have just got far more economic potential than people of my age. I mean, they're just properly educated and properly trained. And I think it is actually a great mistake to look at people of my age and think, you know, and sort of try and learn too much from our experience. Life is quite different for someone of 20 than it was when I was 20. It really is. And you shouldn't generalise from a very thinly educated generation and think, you know, my word, I'm not going to be able to get through, it was so tough for them. You're in a completely different position. And so don't be too sort of weighed down by the past, would be my advice to younger women at the moment. Will it ever change? I mean, I think it's honestly true to say that the pace of change has probably been slower than I would have hoped 30 or 40 years ago. Women have made fewer advances, but I think I was probably rather naive. I didn't really understand the nature of the cultural barriers. I thought it was just a question of organising part-time help with the kids and solving the many practical problems of combining working and family. And it is more deep-rooted than that. It really is. But I do think there have been some, you know, quite deep-rooted trends which have helped women make progress and which may help them make progress as we look ahead. I mean, there's no doubt that women have benefited from the switch from heavy industry to a service-based economy. But I think looking forward, you've got to recognise that some of the services that women have flooded into, call centres and so on, are increasingly exposed to international competition. And women have tended to cluster in non-traded areas, the public sector. I mean, you know, there's competition from low-wage countries, it's a tougher world out there. New technology offers much more possibilities for organising work flexibly now than it did 20 or 30 years ago. I remember working part-time from home. It was an absolute nightmare in the days before, before PCs and all that sort of kit. I mean, remote working is miles easier now, and there's all the technological support. But on the other hand, I do think that the intensification of work, this whole sort of 24/7 culture in high-paid, certainly in high-paid areas and internationally competitive sectors, pulls in the opposite direction. So I think the pace. I think it could go. You shouldn't think that it's a clear cut. I think it could go either way. I think the big issue there is a big issue though, sort of looming. I mean, I think you can say women now have choices in the way they didn't used to have choices. They really do. And if you can, you know, half the battle is in your own mind. If you can recognise the range of choice you've got, women really do have choices. And they have economic independence on a scale and in a way which would have been quite unthinkable to my mother. But it's still true that the economic role of women is secondary. And I think that's for reasons which are in large part cultural. I think there's been a massive secular change if you look over a sufficiently long period of time. But I think Eleanor was right in saying that a lot of the changing has been done by women. Women have had to combine, at least I think it was a very stressful business having children and trying to have a career. The divorce rate for women who tried to do so was, you know, multiples higher than people who led more less stressful lives. If you look at women in senior positions, you will see that they are disproportionately childless. You don't have to go quite to the same extreme of saying you need to lead men's lives, because I don't think it's quite that bad. But there's been great stress on people attempting to do it all and be it all. And I think that's because most of the burden of attempting to realise women's economic potential has fallen on women. And I think the real truth of the matter and the thing that we need to confront is that the fundamental change in the role of women necessarily involves men as well. And I mean, I do think one thing which I find remarkable about this audience is that it does contain a large number of men. 20 or 30 years ago, that simply wouldn't have been the case. It isn't just about the economy. It's about what kind of society we want. And I think that's a very broad and profound question. And really, you know, that's what we should be focusing on. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Rachel. So from the politician through the practitioner, we now turn to the academic, who may cast some light on some of the issues that have been raised. So Professor Susan Himmelwhite from the Open University.
Can you hear me? I can hear me. Well, thank you very much for inviting me. I'm delighted to be here. It's pretty impressive that the Gender Institute's been going 10 years and we still haven't got equality for women. Must be quite a hard job, I would have thought, to make so many changes. I listened to what the other two speakers had to say about their own careers, and I thought a little bit about mine. Mine hasn't been that different. I'm an academic. I teach at the Open University, which means I teach a lot of women, though I don't see them, because a very large proportion of our students are women, and often women who are at home. So it's an important way in which women can get an education. I was thinking that one of the probably the biggest differences in our career is that I'm probably very much worse paid as an academic than our other two speakers.
Not on an MP, you can't work. On
the other hand, I can go one better on the children. We've had one child, two children, and I have three. So it's probably a good thing we don't have any more speakers. Yeah.
I think Harriet probably does have four, actually.
So how are women doing? What do I think about that? Well, actually, I think women are doing very well on the whole. Certainly young women doing. As Rachel said, education is an area in which there's been a huge amount of change for women. And in fact, as you probably know from the newspapers, women are doing much better than men. Well, they're doing better than men educationally. And this started at lower levels with GCSEs, and now they're doing better than men at A levels and beginning to do so in first degrees, and I'm sure it'll work up right through the system. This is because women take education more seriously. And they do appear to be more adaptable to changing economic conditions at work and in other ways, that women in some sense are adapting to a changing economy in ways that some men at any rate find difficult. But unfortunately there's a big divide. While many women are showing exactly what women can do in the economy, there's still a very big wage gap. And this is because some women are doing very badly in the economy relative to men. One way you can talk about this, I've heard it described as the Alla Rednick phenomenon. Alla Rednick is Cinderella backwards. And if you think about women's lives today, they often do live a sort of backwards Cinderella life. That women live happily, but not unfortunately ever after. that men and women have really quite similar careers until she meets her Prince Charming. But Prince Charming is probably no longer her husband, but more likely to be her child. And sometimes it's more than one that makes the real difference. And it's at this point that men's and women's lives diverge. This is the point that Eleanor was making. And it's not only at this point that men's and women's lives diverge, but also it's at this point that a gap opens up between women. And those women who do behave like men, or at least behave like men at the workplace, and don't let their careers be interrupted by caring responsibilities for the little Charmings, or for anyone else, because there are other people whose care needs have big effects on women's lives, they do very well, almost as well as men. Almost, but not quite. Because there are still signs of straightforward, old-fashioned sexist discrimination. But on the whole, women who live, at least at work, men's lives, they don't let the fact that their lives may be different outside impinge on their employment histories, do pretty well. But for this to be possible, to not let the little Charmings interrupt your life, you need a really good salary, because you'll get very little help with paying for their care in this country. And childcare costs in this country are the highest in Europe. So you need really to have quite a good job if you're going to be able to afford to pay somebody else to do that caring and not let it impinge on your work life. If, on the other hand, you do let it interrupt your career, either by reducing the amount of hours you spend at work or by having a gap in it, you'll pay a very high penalty for it. Women who want to reduce their hours usually find they have to leave their existing jobs and take jobs, part-time jobs, which are where they can't use their skills and are likely to be very badly paid. In fact, in this country, unlike many other countries, there is a specific sector of jobs designed around women who want to work part-time and fit those hours around looking after their children. And it's because women are in a vulnerable position in those jobs do tend to be badly paid, and they are formally unskilled. Though in fact, some of them may require quite some skills. They tend to be skills that are not well recognised, skills that women naturally pick up in the home. And it's very difficult to get out of them. Once you're in those jobs, it's hard to move back out of them. So while you see many women working part-time because they have small children at home needing care or are looking after older people who need care, quite a few are not anymore. They used to be looking after them, but they don't find a way to get back into better paid jobs later on. So that's one way. The other way is those women who actually stop work altogether also find much more difficulty getting back into work than one would think would be reasonable if one thinks about how long they've been out of it or what possibilities of retraining might be made possible. So if you take the consequent loss of earnings into account and not only the actual hours that you have not been there earning, but also what effect this has had on your salary, the cost of motherhood is actually very great for women in this country. It's higher than it is in any other European country where this has been studied. And the worse paid you are, the higher the cost of motherhood for you. So very well paid women don't actually pay very much for motherhood. The reason is what they pay is the cost of childcare. They stay at work, they continue with their careers, and the cost they have to pay is the cost of childcare. If they work very hard, they may have to employ 2 full-time nannies. But that is nothing for the period you have to do it compared with ruining your career by moving to part-time work or by giving up work. So the people who pay the highest cost for having children are those women who are worse paid and therefore more likely to drop out of the labour force to have children or to go to yet worse paid jobs through working part-time. They're more likely to do that, partly because they may not be able to afford the cost of childcare, but also if you have, it's more likely if you have a rotten dead-end job that you're going to find the idea of staying at home to look after your children appealing than if you had jobs that were engaging you in the first place. So if you use the choice language, women who choose to give up their careers to look after children are paying a very heavy price for care. Now, what could be done about this? It's clearly not a very satisfactory situation. And there's lots of policy now on childcare. I would have thought it inconceivable 7 years ago, if you think about it, in 1997, that you would actually have the main parties fighting over their childcare strategy. That this is big news today. That in itself, I think, is progress. And I think you'll find that they all talk a lot about choice in the ways of caring for children. It's a very important word to both the two main parties at the moment. Personally, I'm all for choice. But what I'm frightened about is that I think what they will offer will not be real choices. They won't be real choices unless something is done about the long-term consequences of some of those current options. You can give people choices today that can have really dire consequences of their future. If simply giving you a choice in the moment doesn't make much difference unless you're giving people also reasonable pathways for the rest of their lives. My worry is that what you're seeing the political parties offering is, if you like, what one could call a male economist's perspective on care. And that view is one that sees care as an obstacle to the economy, not a contribution to it. So we get this very strongly from the Treasury, that sees providing childcare as a way of enabling more women to take employment, because looking after their children is an obstacle to their employment. The fact that they are carers is an obstacle. It's a bit like a good bus service. That would get them into work too. So childcare is a bit like looking at a good bus service. It's not a view that on the whole seals childcare as something of benefit to the child. But because many women do see childcare as about caring for the child, many will choose to sacrifice their careers to looking after children rather than put them in the bus service type of childcare. There's a second aspect of adopting what I would call this male economist perspective on care. It means that women's caring behaviour can continue to be constructed as a choice, an increasingly irrational one, the higher the costs of doing so. And once you talk about it as a choice, it becomes the people themselves have to take responsibility for it. And if women continue to make such irrational choices, then it will be reasonable that women continue to pay the price for doing so. So what would an alternative be? What would be another way of looking at it? What would be perhaps a woman's view of care? Well, first of all, to see it primarily as of benefit to those being cared for. To see childcare then as a public service that parents would use because they saw it as a good way for their children being looked after. And that would enable choices to be made which put the care of children first rather than the needs of employers. If we don't do that, if we don't see childcare in that way, then it's inevitable that women more than men would choose to sacrifice their economic position to the care of their children or of other people. So To promote equality, as I see it, you need to enable everyone to combine work and caring. That this would not be just an issue for women then, but would be an issue for men. So the same things that would enable women to combine work and caring are at least the prerequisites for men being able to do so. So what's required for that? Well, I think the first thing is to tackle the ridiculously long working hours in the UK. Longer for full-time workers than elsewhere in Europe, sizably so, and it's true for women as well as men. The only reason that the average working hours in the UK are not particularly high in European terms is because of all those women who are working part-time. But if you look at full-time working hours, they are very, very high in the UK. And that's a problem. It's a problem for women who are doing the caring if they want men to share in it. It's also a problem for women who want to get back into full-time work if it's such a big step up from what they might have been doing before. And that would be necessary if we wanted to give everyone a real and lasting choice to be able to have careers and a life that includes caring for others. You have to regulate working hours to do that. I would like to see this government endorse the European Working Time Directive properly. And that means not giving people opt-outs to in pursuit of some formal notion of freedom. It's a notion of freedom that people ought to be able to choose their working hours. But what it really means is enabling those with fewer caring responsibilities to steal a march on those who cannot compete because of their caring responsibilities. So I would see that, doing something about long working hours, as a first step to enabling men and women both to combine caring and employment. We also need family leave of different types, maternity leave, paternity leave, parental leave, and so on, to be paid at near replacement levels. Otherwise, families will not be able to afford to take it, and in particular, they won't be able to allow their higher earner, who in most families is the man, to take it. Third thing that I'd like to see is to give all workers the right to work hours compatible with family demands. So that's to give everyone, not just parents, a right to work hours that fit in with caring responsibilities. I think it's important that everybody gets it, because otherwise those who need it will have to pay the cost of taking those rights in lower pay, having the employers who will trade off that right for worse working conditions. And I would like to see it as a statutory right, not simply a right to request it. Now, this government puts a lot of focus on business to deliver on some of these things. I think that's pretty unfair. I don't think you should expect firms to do this by themselves. I think it's the responsibility of government to look after the conditions in which society as a whole reproduces itself. It's its responsibility to ensure that the economy as a whole is organised to enable people to combine work and caring. And it may decide to do that by putting restrictions on what firms can do, the types of contracts they are allowed to put out, as in the Working Time Directive. But it is quite unrealistic to expect firms to do it themselves, to rely purely on a business case for doing this. If the business case was so strong, firms would be doing it already. And if the business case is not strong enough to get what we need for equality, equality in itself is something that we need, and there are reasons to go beyond that. So I suppose I would like to summarise my aim in all this, as far as the work side goes, is to make men into employees who are just as unreliable as women because of their caring responsibilities. I think the economy would run very much better in those ways. And I think it is also the only way we can get equality. Now, I haven't talked much about the financing of care. But I think that's very important. I do think there is what we can see at the moment is what happens if you simply rely on people to be able to provide their own substitute care. There are small levels of subsidies for low-paid workers, but in comparison with, again, with other European countries, it's very low. Subsidising care is not cheap, and it will get more expensive. It's likely to become relatively more so because you can't raise the productivity of care very easily as you can in other parts of the economy. So relatively, the cost of care is likely to increase. And so whatever the government spends on care now, whatever proportion of GDP is going into care now, will have to increase. It will have to increase faster than GDP if we are to reach equality, and then it would have to keep rising in line with that. It's not cheap to do something about this. Secondly, I think we have to tackle the poor pay of carers, and that's, of course, going to make it more expensive. If we don't tackle the poor pay of carers, we won't have any carers, because women are getting more educated, and they're not going to go into low-paid work where their qualifications are not recognised, where there's no career structure, unless the conditions are improved. That in itself will, of course, raise the cost of doing something about the provision of care for us all. But first of all, the resources are there to pay for this, because these problems are arising because of people trying to get into the economy, of people having productive things to do when they get there. All these are producing more than we need to pay for the care. But also, it's a good thing in itself. If we take a positive view of care, what I've called a woman's view, we don't have to see this as a drain on the economy. It is the economy. It is part of what the economy does. And it's one of the ways in which we can see it as bringing benefit to all our lives. So I'd like to recommend that one of the ways that we look at women in the economy is by taking a care perspective on it, that we expand our notion of what do we mean by the economy to include care, whether it's paid currently or unpaid, but to see the economy as encompassing care itself, but also seeing the ways in which it really matters to us. So it's not just any old commodity, but it's something that is intrinsic to the way we live our lives and necessary to creating more equality between men and women. Thank you.
Okay, some people clearly wish to leave before the discussion, so if we just give those a moment to do so. But what I would like to do then, first of all, I'd like to thank Susan Himmelwhite very much for that talk, which sort of started in looking at women in the economy, discussing policies to expand real choices, which would actually lead to a change in gender relations, which is obviously something of great interest. So what I'd like to do now then is to open the debate up to the floor, and in view of the time, I'll probably take a few questions and then ask speakers to respond, and I imagine they would like to respond to each other as well. So first we have a question over there. So I'll take a few questions at once, perhaps, and then thank you. Yes, no, carry on. Yes.
Okay, I wanted to ask pick up on a comment that Rachel made about roles of women in the workplace and how it's not just about doing a good job, but actually the role that you play socially as well, and linking that to role models. And I wondered how important role models have been for you and if there's anyone in particular that you'd pick out and why.
Okay, a question at the back there. Can you indicate to the person who you are, or maybe this will be.
Speak up a bit.
Yeah, I'm not convinced by the merit of the process either, but I think in the language of
sorry, do I have... yes, over here, please. At the front, yes, thank you.
Children altogether, whereas working class women continue to have children perhaps at the same rate that they always did. And if so, if you do think that that's happening, do you think it matters?
Okay, I think that's actually three quite big questions there, so perhaps we better deal with them. So role models, quotas, and the class divide in children, having children. Do you all wish to respond, or perhaps... Eleanor, you made the question of quotas, so perhaps you should respond to that one first of all.
That work? There. I'll have to stand up because I'm much too small to sit down if I'm ever speaking. Those are good questions. Take quotas first. Oh. I can't stand up because then the light goes directly. That's obviously not a very good idea. How about that? It's not very good, really, is it? it's okay. That will be all right. Will that be all right?
Come with me.
Or maybe if you raise your microphone.
Oh, dear, this wasn't meant to be so difficult. There we are. That's it. That's better. You'll understand what I mean when you stand up. First of all, quotas. No, I will stick to my position on quotas. I hear what you say, and in the Conservative Party, we have this argument all the time about whether we should have all women shortlists for parliamentary seats. And I am still not convinced that we need to take that desperate, defeatist action. I know the Labour Party did it and that it was successful, and they got well over 100 women into Parliament, about half of whom may not have been there had it not been for all women shortlists. And with all due respect to the women in question, I still think it was the wrong thing to do. You'll notice that in the present government, in the Labour Party, the women who are now doing really challenging jobs in government and who are actually succeeding and who are therefore, by definition, the best and most successful members of Parliament are those who got there in the first place on their own merits and not through all women shortlists. And so I'll stick to my anti-quotas argument. You must be allowed it. Yes, you're not wrong, and I wouldn't say that. But I merely say that I think that if you say that we have to have quotas or you have to have positive discrimination, then it is partly giving in on the argument. I still honestly believe that most women will succeed on their own merits. And I know this is a hard line stance that I'm taking, and that many people will argue against it, but I'll stick to my stance because somebody has to. Which brings me to the role model. It's a really easy question to ask a Conservative MP who is a woman. Who is her role model? Now, you're not to throw things, no hissing and booing. It's Margaret Thatcher. Okay, on to the next question. Class divide on childbearing, the statistics do look like that. If you do the economic classes, there's no doubt about it that the so-called middle class are producing fewer children, partly because they're waiting later, and that in itself is producing a delay and therefore fewer children. Does it matter? I don't know. You don't often hear a politician say that. I don't know the answer to that question. If you were to say that it is obvious that the most intelligent people in society are producing fewer children, and that intelligence is passed on genetically, then I would say that's something we ought to worry about. But if you're saying merely that it is that the divide is between those who in the present generation earn more or less than each other, I think possibly no. It probably doesn't matter. But I don't know the answer to the question, and it would be interesting to see an academic study on it.
Let me just have a quick go through these questions. You asked me specifically how important have role models been to me, and the answer is not very, actually. There were one or two women that I definitely didn't want to turn out to be like that I came across. actually, not Margaret Thatcher. I mean, one of the things about Margaret Thatcher is she was a very powerful figure. I mean, even if you didn't sort of approve of what she said, my God, she did sort of, she did sort of take people by the scruff of the neck. She was a powerful figure. All right, hold it like this. On quotas, I do want to say something about this. It's a really difficult one, this. It is appalling to feel yourself the recipient of some form of special action. It really is. It's insulting, it makes you angry, and the idea that it's necessary is infuriating and all the rest of it. But I really don't know how you break through some of these really tough male cultures like the House of Commons. And I think groups matter. And, you know, just this business of one person trying to make it through, having been myself through one or two of these male cultures, I'm afraid I've got very depressed about the idea that one woman changes the world. They don't. They don't. It's not like, life is not like that. And it's also nonsense, I'm afraid, to say that the people who succeed because they've got special merit. They don't. They have a special personality. It tends to be a bit Rottweiler-like. actually, I think Margaret Thatcher was not an accident. She was quite insensitive. And that's one of the things you need to be if you're in a severe minority. And the notion of merit is a very elastic one. I mean, what you need is a special kind of personality to succeed if you're in a small minority. And a lot of people who've got considerable merits actually just don't make it for all the wrong reasons. Class divide in childbearing, I suppose my answer on this is I do think probably younger women have been rather put off, not just by the fact that they're going to have to sacrifice income and this rather depressing analysis that Susan gave us, but also by the sort of women they know who are a bit older and they've seen how frayed and frazzled we've been as we have sort of come through and thought, my God, you know, I don't need to do that. I think my answer to them would be the same as my answer to Susan, which is look forward and don't look back. Economically valuable women will change the world. They will change the workplace. You know, frankly, I mean, the world that we live in today is quite different from the world as it was 40 years ago. 40 years' time, the world of work will not be the same. And one of the things that will have changed it is the fact that, you know, a very large proportion of qualified people will be female and they will be able to call some shots. And they will be able to change the terms of engagement in work. And if you don't believe that's true, you ought to look at what's going on in the public sector, where the part-time work is just transformed, and the whole sort of work-life balance thing has just come on a huge amount in the last 20 years. When I worked part-time, it was a special sort of dispensation to me. And, I was meant to, I had to sort of do all the changing to make it possible. Now people work part-time at every level in the civil service. In some areas, like, for example, the lawyers, it is about the only terms on which you can get decent people to work because, there's a pay differential there and there's a huge number of able women who all work part-time and have reached senior positions. So I just think we shouldn't be too backward-looking in our analysis of what's possible. I think in your calculating whether you're going to have children, I don't think you should look at your mother's experience. You should look and think what might be possible for you.
On that sort of optimistic note, I'd like to take a few more questions, and Sue, you can respond to these in a few moments. We have a question there. There was one somewhere else as well. One over there. And one, right, okay, so we'll take those four questions that I've identified, and Susan, you'll respond first, okay?
It was actually a question for Susan there as well. Vishal Sharma from the Women's Budget Group. I'm sorry if I'm breaking the mold in the kind of line of discussion that we've had, but if I were to sit here as the audience looking at that red LED saying women in the economy since the past hour and a half, I'm beginning to wonder if there is an exclusive emphasis of some sinister sort in a formal paid economy being the only kind of economy there is. Because if you were to look at women's lives across, well, the UK certainly has no excuse given that it's a first world country, but across the world, that there is a very, very powerful parallel segment of the economy called the economy of care, that statistics right back since the 1990s have very convincingly shown is equally important in moneyed terms, if you were to put it that way, if not more than the formal sector. And I'm wondering if you were to look at women in the economy, and if the series for today's debate were to be women into the 21st century, I'm wondering what procedural edifices there are in place to then recognize that there is other women who are not part of the formal economy, who don't contribute to the economy in terms of paid employment, and whether the economy, as some sort of a great god of giving it were to ever reward or adequately compensate for or adequately take account of these women. So these will be single women who don't want to go back into the paid economy. These will be single women who, for whom the lack of adequate training necessitates that they don't go back into the economy. And these will be old women who've passed that stage where they'll contribute to the economy. So what is the status of these women in the economy?
Okay, there's a question over here.
Hello, I had a question I believe that there's a failure in British society right now to actually hold a debate about the role of women in the workplace. The fact that we have not questioned the sort of future of British society, say in 20 years, what politicians actually say they envision for the country in terms of the role of women, particularly when they leave it to businesses to determine, for example, as current legislation stands, whether or not they can grant a woman the right to return to work part-time after having a child. And if we are talking about the role of care in the economy, then where does that leave us if we are not even having, if we are not even discussing this in the media or between politicians in the House of Commons?
Okay, there was another question over there. And then another one over there.
Mine was a quite similar question, actually, in the sense that the equality legislation we have has been around for almost 30 years and hasn't been shown to make a difference in many, many industries. What is needed to make this happen? I'm not convinced that having senior level women is enough. How do we encourage men in industry, senior level men, to take responsibility for this if even having legislation isn't doing the job?
Okay, and
Nick Wilson. I was the impression I got was that basically most of the panel speakers thought that there was no discrimination until such time as you actually had children. Okay, but I think that's actually very accurate from my experience in the city. But what I am a little bit, I won't say horrified, but I'm surprised at was Susan's comment that essentially that I agree with her that basically we need to try to ensure that both men and women can look after children, but I was rather concerned by this idea that providing a sort of a universal childcare is the sort of the way to go, because I think the maternal and the paternal bond between parents and children is actually something that cannot be provided by childcare. And I think that I agree with a lot of what she said, but I think the idea of basically saying that, hey, one way of overcoming the discrimination that occurs once a mother has a child, and therefore, and when the mother or the father then decides they're going to take time out, and therefore then they start being discriminated against, is such that we need to allow for that period of time when either a mother or father can actually provide that that care.
Okay, can I ask the speakers to reply in reverse order?
I'll have a go. I think, is this one working?
Yes.
I think I'm going to try and answer bits of different ones altogether. I think I'm a bit frightened that there is a race between two different tendencies going on. One is a tendency towards more equality, that through some of the things that we've all been talking about, there are forces that are leading to more equality. But there are also other forces in the economy which are not specifically about gender that are making that harder. And in particular, I think it's the... it was interesting what Rachel said about the public sector, for example, leading the way in work-life balance. Well, we're at a time when the public sector is being dismantled and privatised. There is a tendency within talk to talk as though what the private sector is doing is the model for how the public sector should run. I think there are lots of things that we should be learning from the public sector, and this might be one of them. The public sector has, of course, been a leader in a lot of these areas, and I am worried that the sort of tendencies. I think that's where the gloomy tone in my in my talk came from, is precisely because I think some of these other economic pressures are pressures to fine-tune out of the economy any slack that's there, is precisely what puts women at a disadvantage. That women have been very creative in using the little spaces that exist within jobs to enable themselves within careers, with employment structures, to enable themselves actually to manage to combine caring with employment. And as work gets higher, gets more pressured, that becomes harder and harder. So, I mean, that's part of why my talk was a little bit gloomy about that. What would I like to see? Well, I don't necessarily want children in childcare centres. This isn't necessarily my ideal. But I do think people need lives in which they have some balance. They have some balance between being at home and being out in the social world. And this is true for men as well as women. So I would like to see some forms of good childcare available for all children, and for all parents in that sense. But I'd also like to see people able to lead lives in which they spend a lot of time with their children. And they spend a lot of time with other people who need care. This is a long way from where we are, because where we are is in a society where some people spend enormous amounts of time with their children, and some people spend practically none. And I think we need a concentrated effort to move in a direction where we get more of a blend. The one country that seems seriously trying to do that is the Netherlands, where they have an ideal of part-time work for everyone. Part-time work, this is combined with some formal childcare too, so that, let's say, everybody would work 4 days a week, or the equivalent of 4 days a week, and would have one day by themselves with their children, another partner with another day by themselves, and there would be 2 or 3 days for a child in childcare. And that seems to me potentially a nice balance. I'm more concerned with having that sort of balance than having tons of choice, because I am worried that when you get tons of choice for people, you get within households great inequalities growing up, and that's effectively what we're reproducing then at an economic level.
Should I ask Rachel next?
Right, after I sort of slightly lost track of what the questions were, but I do remember somebody asked the question about women who weren't part of the market economy. If I understood the question properly, what was their position? And I'm afraid that I had just one word answer to that, and their position is likely to be poor. I mean, the sad thing is that's the world we live in, whether we like it or not. And one of the great benefits of women joining the world of paid economy is that they have got financial independence. And that's a huge gain. I mean, women used to lead rotten lives. It certainly does. Exactly. And that's just, I think we do need to kind of remember the main drivers of the economy. And it's not just the UK. I mean, we've tended to talk, and I think, I agree with an awful lot of what Susan said, but except for one thing, you have to recognise that we live in a very competitive world economy. I mean, last week I was in China, in the Pearl River Delta, where most of the goods that we buy in the shops are made. And they are made by girls between the age of 17 and 25, working 17 hours a day for an absolute pittance, for wages that have not risen in 15 years. It's worth just remembering. One of the reasons why life is so tough and frightful in the city is because it's incredibly competitive. The business doesn't need to be done here. It could be done somewhere else. Now, it's perfectly possible to be anti-growth about all this and say, let's all be poorer and a lot happier. But what I don't think the choice is to say, let's go on being incredibly rich compared with everybody else in the world, and let's just lead a leisured life as well. I mean, there are some tough choices to be made. So I think that's part of it. But I do think that, the central point that was being made, that work-life balance is not just for women, it's about the way in which we organise our lives, and men organise their lives as well as women, and the way in which we organise our lives throughout the whole of our working life. I mean, the idea that you work yourself senseless for 10 years while your children are young, and then you retire and spend 30 years going on saga holidays, seems to me to be crazy. We just need to sort of even out work across our life a bit more, and so that we can do the things we want to at the time when we can. And having some time for our children when they're young seems to be a really important priority. But I think at the other end, you probably end up working a bit longer for your pension. That's certainly what I'm doing.
Well, more very good questions. The two people over there asked about legislation at present not working, and one of you said that, first of all, that it's not right to leave businesses to decide about their employment of people, of women returning after childbirth, etc., etc. Well, to an extent, that is the case, and we have to have some regulations and legislation to deal with this, and it is right what we're doing on maternity leave and maternity pay and paternity leave as well, and flexibility for flexibility in the workplace for mothers and fathers of young children, but also for people who have caring responsibilities. That is also important and ought to be required, but we have to be very, very careful, because if you allow the pendulum to swing too far so that the regulation which is put on business by government makes it impossible for business, especially small businesses, and remember a very large proportion of people who are employed in the UK today are employed in small businesses. They're not all employed by Microsoft or I don't know, any Barclays Bank. It might be quite easy for a large company to deal with these issues, but for small businesses, it's very important to have the right balance. And what will happen if we put too much regulation onto small businesses? They won't employ women in the first place. That's all that will happen. And therefore, women's position will be undermined and not enhanced by it. So it's important to get the balance right there. And somebody else over there said that these issues are not talked about in politics. Yes, they are. I talk about them all the time. And I wonder why it was that we found last Thursday that Michael Howard and Tony Blair were both at nurseries both photographed with small children, both announcing, oh no, this going, oh my goodness, both announcing, this is telling me that there's a vote about to take place in the House of Commons on hunting. Both announcing that they really care. It's okay. It's more than an 8 minute warning. We normally get an 8 minute warning. It's a slightly longer than 8 minute warning. Both announcing that childcare and caring and the work-life balance is important in planning our manifestos for the next election. So I'm afraid you're simply wrong to say that it's not being talked about. It is being talked about a lot, and it's being reasonably well reported in most of the press as well. On the care economy, that is also taken into consideration. What Michael Howard, your point about the care economy is a very good one. What Michael Howard said last week, and I'm not going on about conservative policy here, it's just that I know it better than Labour policy, and I expect that since this is a good policy, if Tony Blair hasn't already announced it as his policy, he will quite soon, because he usually does when we come up with a good policy. So this is not party politics. This is just saying that generally in the political world, the point you made is recognised. And that what we have suggested is that there ought to actually be, for mothers who choose to stay at home, there ought to actually be a straight cash benefit for the first 5 years of a child's life. And likewise, there ought to be some kind of recognition in the tax system or benefit system for people who look after elderly relatives. And somebody over here, this gentleman here, talked about childcare and not putting children in sort of baby farms. Quite right, of course we don't want that kind of childcare. We want flexible childcare which is suitable for each family in different circumstances. But you said, sir, you implied that the right person to look after a child in the early years is a parent. We've got past that. Some people believe that and some people believe that there are other ways that you can look after a child. And I put it to you like this as I run out of the door, that you will probably find it fairly acceptable that I am leaving early now because I have to vote in the House of Commons. What would you have said if I had said to you that I won't be here at 6:30 this evening, I wouldn't be here until 7:15 because my 3-year-old son goes to bed at 7 and it's my first duty to put him to bed? Don't you think I would rather have been doing... No, I'd much rather have been with you today, but most of the things that I normally do at 7 o'clock, I would much rather be putting my son to bed and giving him the care and attention he deserves from his mother. But if I did that, then people would say, you can't do your job, you must choose. That's what they would say in the harsh reality of the real world. They would say, if I insisted on never being at a meeting at 7 o'clock, coming to something like this at 7:15 instead of 6:30, you can't do your job. That's what they'd say. And that's what we are all up against. And we haven't yet got the solutions, but we're trying.
Okay, well... I can't take any more questions. I'm sorry, we're going to have to end the debate there. I wish to thank all the speakers, and clearly politicians need to solve their own problems as a starting point in terms of work-life balance, but there's lots of issues for us to study as academics into the future, so I think the Gender Institute will be here in another 10 years. On that note, can I remind you that there's... I want to thank all the speakers in a moment, but just that there is another lecture on Monday, the 22nd of November, concerned with women in the media, which I think will possibly think about how issues of gender issues have been actually represented, and perhaps that's another way forward that we haven't discussed this evening. So on everyone's behalf, I'd like to thank the speakers very much, and thank you all for coming. Thank you.